maybe we can. So I don't know. We don't have really a very precise program. It meant much more to be a conversation and to sort of, you know, having Charles here. I told him I would like him to speak much more because it's time we should have him here and finally have his story. And you know, we departed from this video because this video was the beginning of the project, and this was 2 years ago already, and my first visit to Boden was already 3 years ago. So in that sense, the project developed a lot in all senses, and it seems to, I mean, in each place it has its own specificity, and one of the projects that I would like more to speak about exactly because we have Charles here is what happened in the Van Abbe Museum, and particularly because we were particularly skeptical about having the project there, because as long as it is in a place where we are living, so in that sense, the north where I used to go quite frequently, but also we activated the living room in ArcDIS, the Museum of Architecture, here, and it still felt home. It still felt that I have my living room in the house in Stockholm, and still actually expropriating part of the public in order for me to be part of this public and to claim the public. But then when we had to do the exhibition, the larger exhibition of in position for the part of permanent temporariness there, the question was, should we or shouldn't we do the living room, and what does that mean? And if we are speaking about a project of or an exhibition of a certain amount of time, then what the living room can be doing there. And actually, surprisingly, and in a sense, I want to begin the story and then let Charles finish it, because basically, I mean, what we were speaking before I left to Eindhoven, that, you know, I would go there to make a last check and then to say we cannot do the living room, right? This was a bit like the hidden agreement between me and Alessandro that it would be too much to do the living room there. It might be compromising the project, so it's better not to do it. But then I arrived to the Van Abbe and things shifted immediately. But before telling you my own story, because I told it several times, I asked Charles if he can tell us the story from his point of view, because, you know, I all the time tell my own story, and I don't know if I met Shafiq by chance or it was planned that I meet Shafiq, if, you know, there are so many things that happened to me, and I didn't know that if there was, as we had a sort of hidden plan, they might have a hidden plan that we don't know. So in that sense, you know, my plan is first to hear his story and then to speak more, and maybe to open up the project for other things, and I would tell you what happened later on in Boden. But first, you're not Charles, so I'm throwing you the
thank
ball
you.
For
okay,
the story.
I'll try and catch it. So maybe to start with the background before Sandy came, to some extent, around the museum a little bit. And I suppose you can imagine the Van Abbe Museum as a sort of classic imprint or footprint of the Museum of Modern Art in New York, essentially. So everything that's wrong and right about that institution in New York was basically exported after the Second World War to many, many places in American-occupied Europe, I would say. Yeah? So Moderna Museum at the same is also a footprint of that institution, more or less, and its ideology. And of course, that ideology, we could say very simply, is an ideology of modernism, but also of modernity, so the longer histories, which essentially is an ideology of white supremacy, to say very, very simply. Yeah? So this is in a sense our civilizational responsibility as an organization is to maintain white supremacy. This is where we come. Now, of course, that's never spoken about in those ways. Yeah? It's never articulated in those ways. But it's essentially about, say, the value of an Enlightenment heritage, which is reinvented after the Second World War, after the end of the Enlightenment, supposedly in the camps, as something which would enlighten and civilize the populations in the locality. And that's more or less. And it's hard to get away from that thing now. Of course, as the world has changed in the last 70, 80 years, The Van Abbe Museum opened in 1936, but really became a modern museum just after the Second World War, so around 1947. So it's really has this very much this trajectory, kind of baby boomer trajectory, you could say, yeah, somehow that generational perspective. As you know, in a simple way, Eindhoven diversified in all the ways that we mean diversification. And we can talk about diversification in terms of ethnicity, also in terms of interest, also in terms of individualism. Less class politics as well. You know, the diversification happens at many different levels. Yeah, in Western society, then that old model, in a sense, of the modern art museum, is creaking. Yeah, it's creaking and rubbing against all the things that it doesn't fit in anymore. And one of the things clearly is the fact that, you know, the majority of the people that come to the museum still today, it's changing, but it's changing slowly, are still white, highly educated, slightly more female than male, ethnic Dutch. Yeah, that's the majority of the visitors. But that's not actually the majority of the people in Eindhoven. Yeah, so there's a very particular selection of people that are coming to the museum. And one of the tasks that we have, which is a very hard task given that history of the institution, is to try and shift the kind of dialogues that we can have with people. So I think that's, in a sense, where we were coming from and why for me doing the project was so important, to try and see if we could make it work. But I think also the suspicions that Sandy had about doing it were also based on all those presuppositions, reasonable suppositions, of what the institution stands for and what it is. And I think one of the ways in which we've been trying to think about how to have different kinds of conversations in the building is through also, you know, within sort of the colonial theory, something that Rolando Vasquez Malkin talks about, which is decolonial listening. Yeah, trying to listen rather than imagine, which is always the sort of, I think, the position that a curator often adopts, which is a position that what we do is do research and we figure out what's going on and then we tell people what's going on. But actually this listening requires a different kind of register. And I don't think it's not about exclusively one or the other, but if you tune into the idea of listening, then you start to operate in different ways. You start to turn slightly your attention away. You're not looking for the sort of opportunity to project an artist into the art world or whatever. You start to think about, okay, well, what am I hearing and how can I respond to that? Because you're still responding to it. It's not that you become a sort of a totally blank page. You're still responding, but you're responding to different inputs in a way if you start to listen. So all those things were sort of going on at the same time as we started talking, probably 18 months before the exhibition, actually, about the exhibition. And the exhibition was agreed, and I think you were happy about it. I mean, you know, questions about showing in a museum and being artists and all that thing, and, you know, which name would we use, Dar or Alessandro and Sandy, or, you know, all those things. I mean, there were lots of negotiations around their work, which of course for me makes their work so valuable and fascinating, because it asks some of those fundamental conditions of, you know, often Sandy will talk about, am I an artist, am I an architect, am I, what, you know, what is it that I, you know, that, what is it that I qualify as in this environment? And it's because the environment are so rigidly divided by, let's call it modernity for a shorthand, yeah? They're so rigidly divided that they don't fit in, rather than the fact that it's their problem. It's the problem of the divisions that are not there. And I think, so they challenge, in a sense, in lots of ways, the institution to think differently, think in relation to all those disciplines around art, like design or architecture or social sciences or whatever, and how those things cross over, connect. But then the living room was something that sort of occurred really during the start of the talk, and you started talking about it in Boden, and when it was developing, really, when the first sort of steps were being made. And for me, I had to say that it was both very interesting, but I thought, how on earth could that work in our situation? So I was also not sure that we could really do justice to the idea in Van Abbe. But I also saw the value in terms of this colonial listening and in terms of creating conditions where other people could speak on behalf of the museum and hopefully create other dialogues in terms of that diversification of a society which has not been mirrored in a diversification of the institutions. Yeah, that this might be a way. So in the back of my head is this sort of theory, you know, diversification questions of listening, And in the front of the head is this project. And how can you bring those two together, or is it impossible? You know, and sometimes I don't know if the institution can stretch enough. You know, it's a pull for institutions to do things like the Living Room project. And so that was, I think, more or less when you arrived. I think that was more or less my thinking. Yeah, it was like, I really, really want to do this, but I don't know whether we can do justice to it. And I don't want to do it. And I was conscious, I don't want to do it in a false way. Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't have let us anyway do it in a false way. But, so that I didn't have to worry about it. But also, in other circumstances, I wouldn't want to do something which actually hadn't got any, which was a theatre, in a way. And so then we sort of... That's really the picture, and then the figure, really in crucial figure, I think, of Shafiq comes in to play in this sort of matrix, yeah, of thoughts and of possibilities and of ideas, which are sort of spinning around, I think, in very different ways, but in both our heads. Like, can we do this? Can't we do this? Why should we do this? Why should we not do it? You know, all those questions are bouncing around, and this sort of theory is informing this very sort of pragmatic question of, can we put a room in a space in a certain way? And so Shafiq is a very important, in a way, an important person in the museum in a certain sense. So he's a refugee from Afghanistan, so from an earlier wave of migration that came through in the 1990s. Was on his way to England because he had distant family in England, but got stopped in Schiphol in the airport and was arrested, and eventually, through a long process, got Dutch citizenship and was to some extent given a job, because we're part of the city council. I'm sure you have the same in the welfare state system here. Yeah. So in those days, the welfare state system doesn't work like that anymore, perhaps, sadly. But in those days, there was a chance for somebody who was offered asylum, which he was offered eventually. He has a long backstory in Afghanistan, including being a bodyguard, and he's also a painter. He paints. He's an artist as well. And he was given a job in the city council, and that job happened to be what's called the boder in Dutch. It's almost the sort of the janitor or the gopher or whatever in the museum. Yeah, which is a half day job, half time job, and I mean, the sort of anecdotal story is that I don't drive, and sometimes, and if I need to go to an airport which is not Schiphol, then I need somebody to drive it, or I need a meeting. And so he was driving, so we sat quite a lot in the car, and we started talking about things. And he started telling me about Afghanistan, and started talking about, you know, that he wants to try and do something back there. I mean, it's very familiar immigrant story about how can you make connection back. Yeah, that it's not about one way. Migration is not a one way street. It's a two way street. I think, all, you know, but it's very naturally, it's always this sense of, okay, even once you've established something there, then what happens in relationship to where you came from, and how do you keep that connection going or not? And it's always playing in your mind, I think, as a migrant myself, in a certain sense. And so we started thinking what we could do in Afghanistan that would make sense. And he was going back. He went back, I think, two or three times in the last 10 years. It's not so easy to go back, and it's not so safe. But we've developed various relationships and projects with Afghanistan as a result of Shafiq, and in a way as a result of those conversations, those you know, chance conversations in the car, with both of us speaking, I mean, at the time, and still to some extent speaking broken Dutch to each other, you know, to try to understand. So that developed into a Skype academy that we developed with six cities in Afghanistan, where we would have groups of people that would gather in certain places like this, and then there'd be a Skype connection, which didn't always work because the internet isn't that great in Afghanistan. But then we would sort of take them around the museum, or talk about art history, or talk about some of the projects that we were doing. Different people would teach, the curators, but also the educators, the people who do the guided tours and things like that. I mean, different people in the museum. One artist who we met through that process, called Malina Suleiman, had problems as a woman. She was doing graffiti, which the people in Kandahar, she's from Kandahar, which is one of the more religious centers in Afghanistan, the people didn't like, so she had to get out quite short notice, so we managed to get her to the Netherlands and eventually to get her residency as well. So she's sort of around in Eindhoven as well, and that's a sort of legacy in a way of that whole discussion. And can I tell a story, an anecdote? The nice story is well, not the nice story. I mean, it shows you the situation in Afghanistan. I think that the director of the National Gallery in Kabul, in the capital, came over, and we were trying to set up a kind of collaboration with the National Gallery, thinking about what museum knowledge that we had from, you know, conservation and storage knowledge to various other things, quite basic things really about the connection. It was a man called Wali, and he it was at the time there was an exhibition which I had problems with, which was in the Documenta of 2012, we're doing something in Afghanistan, and we'd seen that there were problems with it, and he'd had problems with the exhibition that had happened in Kabul as a result of the Documenta. And so he went to the Documenta at a certain point, and then he disappeared. And he actually just ran away, and we found out later that he sought asylum, and it was easier to seek it at that time, I think it still is, in Germany than it was in the Netherlands. So as soon as he got to a place in Germany, then he organized some people to pick him up, and he disappeared. He lives in Aachen now. So that was a sort of, you know, so that ended the collaboration basically, because there wasn't much more collaboration to do. But so that whole history was playing with Shafiq, who also is somebody who's, you know, within the museum is I think respected but seen as a kind of difficult character in a way as well, in a certain sense, but also because of the cultural differences and things like that. So it's always a negotiation to work with him. So with the ethnic Dutch people, who sort of, you know, on the one hand want to be generous in that way that Europeans do, but on the other hand really don't, yeah, sort of struggle with that tension. And I don't know whether it was deliberate or accidental. I think it was probably a little bit of both somehow, you know. that Sandy then met Shafiq, and Shafiq started to talk about some of the things that he did, but particularly you talked about this sort of fundamental idea of this living room, which is that you don't have to always be a guest if you're a foreigner. And I think that's such a profound idea with so many implications. Yeah? The idea that you become a host. I mean, there's, you know, Derrida's written about sort of radical hospitality and tried to theorize it in terms of, you know, he says in his book, you have to be hospitable to the point where you give the key over. But I actually think that going from a guest to a host is a far more interesting and profound, has far more interesting and profound consequences than this idea of just giving the key to your house, which is what Derrida says. It's actually much more meaningful than Derrida's idea of a sort of radical hospitality. A radical hospitality would be to become a guest in your own house, which feels a more reasonable challenge in a way than just giving things away, but also feels a more emotional challenge. Yeah? In a sense, walking away is the easiest thing you can do. In a sense, says, oh, here's, you know, that's almost like the European saying, okay, well, we've given you a passport, now go away. But actually engaging in the idea of being a guest would mean that you also had responsibilities as a guest in this reversal of roles. So I think that meant a lot to him. At the same time, we were trying to think about how to work with the diversity of Eindhoven, which has been increasing a lot even in the last 15 years. And there was actually an existing living room, in a certain sense, a place that was called Huiskamer, which is living room in Dutch, which was located actually quite near to where my apartment is. And this was for people that I don't know whether you have it in Sweden. In the Netherlands, we have a very strange status of people, which is called, how would you translate it? Processed asylum seekers. Asylum seekers that have already reached the end of the process of applying for asylum and have been denied asylum. So they've gone through the whole process, they haven't got asylum, but they're not actually, because of this tension between we want to be nice, we don't actually want to be nice. Yeah? So they're not actually sent out of the country, they're not put on planes, mostly. In some cases, but limited number of cases. But mostly they live in this kind of limbo existence, yeah, these people, because they are not allowed to earn money, they're not allowed to get a job, they don't have papers, they can't leave the Netherlands, but also they're not forced to go, you know, whatever back would mean in the sort of language of migration politics.
And so the We Are Here movement.
We Are Here movement in Amsterdam is the same, yeah? And there's a lot of, I wouldn't say tension, there's an interesting discourse between the people in Eindhoven and the people in Amsterdam. The people in Eindhoven feel the people in Amsterdam are politicizing themselves and theatricalizing their position. Mm-hmm. And what the people in, and I'm not making judgment here, the people in Eindhoven would say is that we just try and work with the people. We don't want to make it into a huge political campaign, which is what We Are Here have done. We actually just want to, in a way, go under the radar, but actually make sure that people's lives are a bit better than they could be. So a sort of pragmatism versus an idealism, you could say, but also a sort of politicization against a sort of a grassroots activism. And it's an interesting tension between those two. So We Are Here is a much louder group of people in who do very good work and important work in Amsterdam, and they occupy churches and set up living areas. And the house camera in Eindhoven is not a place where you can stay overnight, but you can stay for most of the day, and you can get very cheap, often free food, and there are lunches that are prepared and things like that. And Sandy's been there a couple of times and met people. And so we actually went with Sandy, I think initially some of my colleagues went, and then we went together and we started to talk to some of the people there. We met somebody from Palestine. Mm-hmm. And so the combination, in a way these two things came together. So Shafiq's sort of role in the museum, wanting to be this host in a way, and feeling like this was something that he could take on. At the same time, this connection with the house karma people, with the other living room, don't we? And our desire from the museum to have this space in here. So all those sort of coincided, I suppose, to put pressure on you to say yes, and to make it possible. At least that's how I saw it, and then. And then we had to decide the location, and we had to decide various things about the space in the building, that it should be in a part of the building is free to access and part of the building you pay for. Mm. And it was very important it was in a free space. And in the end, we got a space which was by the entrance. And it was, it had very much this appearance, but it was actually more Afghan. So there was an Afghan carpet rather than an Arabic carpet. There were these cushions but there was Afghan tea was served, and the sweets were Afghan sweets rather than, so there was this sort of Afghan element that came into it, I think, for the first time because of Shafiq, and Shafiq as the host and sort of determined certain things. And what I can say, it was, and we want to bring it back, so that shows you how successful it was. But I think what was really successful is that you have a sort of idea as a museum, I suppose, that you should be, some museums have this idea that museums in places that are not tourist centres that just process people through seeing the Mona Lisa or something, yeah? So mm-hmm. there's that identity of the museum, which I don't think is interested in these questions. But I think a lot of museums are interested in how you can create a place where people can encounter each other. Yeah? So the museum is not only this sort of rigorous, I would say, sort of, MoMA, Museum of Modern Art, New York, footprint of a place where you encounter in these anonymous white cubes art. Yeah? So it's not only about this encounter with the fetish, if you like, of the artwork and this sort of singular encounter with it, which is very much the sort of discourse of the modern museum. But rather, it should be an encounter between people, in a sense that the art forms has the capacity, we like to think, to bring people together in ways that they wouldn't come together otherwise, yeah, in the sort of stratifications of society, particularly sort of modern Western or contemporary Western societies, where this stratification can be quite extreme, yeah, we're sort of isolated both individually and then within our sort of social groups, and a lot of stuff happens online, and online is always a kind of a selected community. Yeah, it's always who your friends are on Facebook or whatever. This is always sort of self-selected communities. And actually society is not self-selected. It's whoever happens to be there. So there's a sort of, that notion of society, is we're kind of losing track of it, I think, to a certain extent. And that's where a lot of conflicts come and identitarian politics comes in, because of this loss of the idea that there's something more than the we that I've determined to be the we. Yeah, the we that I've chosen. So So there's another we. There's a we that's just the people that happen to be in a particular location. And the museum is, because the one thing that the museum can offer that the iPhone can't, in a way, is this three-dimensional bodily experience. Yeah, it's asking people, especially today, a huge amount to actually leave their house and stop looking at their screen and go to a museum. I think it's a huge request these days. Yeah, it's almost mind-boggling that anybody does it, because everything is far more interesting on the screen than it is anyway in three-dimensional life. But yet we still have these bodies, and we still have this to some extent, this idea that our physical existence is something that we value. And the museum somehow, that's the thing that's got to offer. Yeah, it's a three-dimensional space. It's got this idea that you actually put your body into space and you move through that space, and that's something you can't do on the screen. It's certainly not, the museum's no longer about giving people access to images, which is its traditional role. Because you can have that whenever, now we could look at the Mona Lisa as much as we like. We can put it on the screen and we've got it more close than we could ever get to it in the Louvre. But being in the Louvre is about moving your body to Paris and walking into that room. It's that's the added value, if you like. So that's the reason that museum should exist at all, I think. And so, if that's true, then obviously this sort of encounter of other bodies is a kind of fundamental aspect of the museum, no? And that's something that we're always getting stuck in, because always what tends to happen is we invite groups, but the groups are again these self-selected we's, these we that are determined by the I. And what the living room did, I think, I'm talking too long now, but what the living room did was allow these encounters to happen that I've never seen happen before in the museum, which was these encounters between the host. So it wasn't only Shafiq that was hosting, he did it a couple of days a week, but there were people from this House Karma, this other place, that we organized on a rota system, who would come and be in the space and tell their stories of where they're from. So there was this encounter between this white, highly educated group of people who go to museums and these other people who were not white and highly educated, or not in every case highly educated. And they also obviously brought people that they knew or friends and things like that. So there was an encounter which became more complex than that. Yeah, because there was an encounter with other people who would come and have tea with their friend in the museum and then encounter this group which is pretty much divided from each other. Yeah, they're unlikely to be friends on Facebook and things like that, those two groups. So, or whatever it is, Snapchat these days. But I know I'm old, if I'm into Facebook. So extraordinary encounters happen. So at one point Shafiq was actually there and he started talking to somebody about Afghanistan and coming from Afghanistan. And the guy sort of said, I know this and I know Kabul and things like that. And he was a bit surprised. He said, eventually he said, so how do you know? He said, well, I've been there quite a lot. And then at the end, he gave him his card and he was the Dutch ambassador to Afghanistan. Who had been sitting there and who had randomly walked into the museum as a civilized Dutch civil servant, but had then suddenly encountered his own professional life somehow in a certain way in the museum, which was sort of an extraordinary coincidence. But it didn't feel that ridiculous in the context of how the living room worked, because what would happen often is that you would walk in, you might see the exhibition first, or you might go straight into the living room and start a conversation which was nothing to do with the art on the walls, which was nothing to do with this idea of a sort of propagandizing of art by the institution, this sort of missionary role that the traditional museum has, to convince people that modern art or even contemporary art has some value in their lives or whatever, which is sort of where we're coming from generally. Yeah, we're quite like priests and like missionaries, I think, and wanting to convert people somehow. And none of that was happening. Yeah, it was just an encounter on some cushions. In a sense, the rest of the museum disappeared, I think, sometimes for people. And that was even something that some of our more traditional colleagues were a bit worried about. where's the art? It's there. That's why we're here. But so So those conversations that happened also, there were people that had originally come from Kenya, from Palestine, from Somalia, from Syria. Each of those stories, and I met some of them, and I didn't meet others. Were all remarkably touching in a way, remarkably full. Yeah. Remarkably layered and dense, because they were the story of a biography, they were the story of a human being. Yeah? And if that was the place that they started from. Can I?
Thank you.
My throat's dry. Shukran. So that's it, really. I think I've talked enough, haven't I?
No, that's great. Thank you very much. But I would like actually now to tell you my story, because this would be a way to sort of put the dots together. So basically, from being skeptical, I went to Eindhoven and I arrived to the ticket place and I asked them to call Charles so someone can come and pick me up. In this 15 minutes sort of wait, or 10 minutes. Luckily, I don't know, Charles was busy, so he had things to do, and luckily he was a bit late. it's not any creepy. I was so, and actually when he arrived, I say, Charles, great that you were a bit late. So I had this moment, and I met Shafiq, because Shafiq was there actually as a security guard, mm-hmm. standing nearby the door. I didn't know him, but... And out of curiosity, we began to talk, and I began to tell him about the living room, and my computer was on my back. So I showed him the video that we just saw. And he immediately, actually, without even hesitating a bit, he says, but I want to be the host. So he completely proposed himself with no hesitation at all. And I say, fantastic. And I still remember... Actually, when Charles came and told him, I can come back to Stockholm now. And he says, what is going on? We have a great program for you. And I say, I figure it out. That's it. And he says, but wait, we have really amazing, we have prepared amazing program for you. But I felt immediately that, my host is already there. He's ready. And he's even proposing himself. So it wasn't in the case of Yasmin and Brahim, we sort of slowly figure it out together. But in the case of Shafiq, he was just like, yeah, I want to be the host. So we would get, I would go and visit all these places, and I realized that it's these places all are about how then the details of the project were going on, and then exactly we would encounter another place actually entitled, it's called The Living Room. So it was incredible, this living room in and living room out, and what does that mean? And I agreed with Shafiq that we would continue talking on Skype. I mean, I left and we continued talking on Skype. And then when I came back to Stockholm with Alessandro, we thought, I met Shafiq in that place and he normally stands there. And as architects, if you think about what is a living room for that person, because in a sense, we had in mind the person to whom we should build the living room, right? So it really make it much visible and much easier for us to understand where it is. And we decided to do it at the threshold of the museum, so where Shafiq normally stands, between before where I spend my first 20 minutes with him chatting. So simply to talk about, and in that sense, it would permit people to get in and be part of the living room without necessarily getting inside the museum. And so, and that's it. We design it, and I arrive to Eindhoven to make the furniture then. I mean, we're thinking, and I even went with Shafiq a bit to think. I told him it would be nice to have a round carpet rather than, and I only brought with me the covers of the pillows, right? And at a certain point, Shafiq says, but this is my living room. And I would like, he was really sort of moving forward alone. And this is like the best part of the project. He says, this is my living room. And I would like to bring actually my carpet from my home as part of the living room. So I can feel home. So he brought his carpet. And then I came in the morning, and Shafiq was hesitant to sit on the pillows. And this actually was my first really encounter with, honest one in many ways, with Muslims that don't read Arabic, right? And in a sense, he says, you know, I cannot sit. This is a holy language. I cannot sit in that holy language. And I was just like, but we don't have this in the Arab world. And you know, I never encounter anybody telling me I cannot sit in Arabic. And he says, exactly because we don't read it, and we are unable to distinguish if it's holy or not, we decided all is holy, right? And I say, okay, Shafiq, so I can tell you exactly where you are sitting, what you are sitting on. You can take your time. And the second time I came, he was sitting on the cushion. So I take it one by one and make a whole translation of where we are sitting on, so he feels safe and he is not sitting in any holy sort of language. I mean, any holy pillow, cushion. And so we began the whole thing, and it was amazing. You know, Shafiq began to sort of take completely over, and for me it was really great feeling that I, you know, no responsibility at all. I was a perfect guest in this living room, and he was really inviting everybody, whoever is arriving, is like, come in, and very natural in all ways. I mean, hospitality is really part of his dough, so he didn't need to have any training. And at a certain point, he was just like, Charles, I think you should stay here and host for one day so you can understand what is it all about. So he was even challenging people of how much hospitable he thinks he is, and sort of challenging everybody around, are you able to host the way I am hosting? Really incredibly. The second time I arrived to Eindhoven, there was already actually the inclusion of a lot of rejected asylum seekers in the room. But what was new for me, that I have to say that I learned sitting together with them, when they told me, because in my mind I was continuing to thinking before arriving the second time, is that this is the space where, you know, it became a living room for many people that would come and encounter and be together, and mainly among refugees, because one of the things that we had as a difficulty in Buden is that we never managed to break community of refugees and community of other people living in the city. And we are still working on this in many ways, and where refugees want to host. But the major thing, I mean, in Buden, the first problem that we encounter is the isolation. So first we wanted to work on the isolation and then on the other things. But in Eindhoven, I was thinking this would be a great space for them to encounter. And slowly speaking, what I learned that was completely new for me, that they say, you know, this is not the place for us to meet among each other, because we have so many other, I mean, we have the living room outside in the city. This is the place where we can meet people that we have never chance to meet. And not only, they were even adding to this, telling me that basically inside the museum, people do not fear them. I mean, they can be normal, they are sitting like us, they are even the one hosting, so they have the power of hosting, and they have it all, right? And they say same exact people, only outside of the door of this museum, would be afraid to talk to us. And they say this is for us a way to advocate for our stories, and they immediately, actually, what was really amazing, that they immediately understood the added value of having the living room at the threshold of the museum. And they were telling me how many, ambassadors, politicians, famous singers. I mean, they met so many people there. And they say it's an exposure to the city that we would ever, never be even dreaming of, because people would not speak with us the same way if we are outside. And I guess that this was really maybe the super new thing for me to understand why a living room at the entrance of the museum might make sense, right? So and then I would tell the third time I went there, we went for the launch of the book, the Permanent Temporaries. And while I was in the coffee shop, Shafiq come to me and he says, I think that the museum should acquire the living room. And, you know, I told him, Shafiq, I don't think that this is a great idea because, you know, I was completely sort of hesitant. But then I thought, but he says, yeah, but this is my living room and I think that they should acquire it. Of course, I mean, you are fully right. It is, I mean, in all senses, if I want to be coherent with myself, it is his living room. And this what was it? And so I say, yeah, but we can discuss it. And so I left it. And I didn't know that we got inside. And there was a session to speak about the living room. Shafiq took the microphone. We were all sitting on the stage. He took the microphone, looked at Charles. And Charles, and he told Charles, Charles, I think that we should acquire the living room. And then Charles looked at me and he says, what do you think? I was like, oops, all in public now. And I say, you know, I cannot stop it. It's not on me to stop it. But certainly I can negotiate your contract. So I and Charles and I say, then we negotiate the contract. And he says, I'm happy about it. And then, luckily enough, we didn't go to the acquirement. For me, this was really the best solution that we can ever have. I mean, our last Skype with Charles, and this is where we are right now, mm-hmm. that he says, instead of thinking about the acquirement, why not to think about putting back the living room where it stands at the entrance of the museum as a permanent temporariness installation where without necessarily an expiring date, but we have it as long as it stands. I mean, people put tents or put many other things as long as they stand. And if Shafiq is not there and another host will come or no other host will come, that's it. I mean, it will expire when it will expire. And for me, this is the best way to think the living room. But from now on, now it's our task to think what does that mean. But this is where we are in this moment in the living room in the Van Abbe Museum. And there are other places where things are also moving forward, but I guess it would be nicer maybe to concentrate on one part of it. And yeah, I don't know. If...
I mean, it's interesting what you're saying because yesterday night we were at Densta and we were talking about the Salent University. Now, of course, there the institution decided that it was important to keep it as a part of the institution. So a component that really changed the way the institution was thinking itself in connection to the community around it. So it's very much along the same lines mm-hmm. that a museum can decide about a permanent, temporary installation of such a project. No? Mm. And you were talking about how these projects also pull the museum
One of the protocols of the museum, at least for now, but I think other museums, art museums, is that the artist is privileged. So actually, if you want to pull the museum, the easiest way is to pull it through art projects, because then people will line up behind it. If you didn't have an artist behind it, it would be seen as a sort of ideological. I mean. Mm-hmm. It's absurd in the most ideological setting you can imagine, a modern art museum. People will say, ah, but you're being ideological by pushing it in a certain direction, you know, which is absurd, yeah, given the origins of this institution and how much it's driven by ideology. But that ideology is somehow transparent, and if you bring a question to it, it becomes visible, and that visibility is what they're resisting. But then you have to go back, I mean, this is often what I'm confronted with, I think, in different ways, to sort of negotiate with the protocols that exist of the institution, and the possibility to change that based on the whatever observation or understanding or listening occurs in the immediate society, but also in wider terms. Yeah? And that's this tension is great, yeah, and a reasonable tension. Yeah, it's not a bad tension because you don't want to just have institutions are sort of, you know, slow beasts for reasons. Yeah, mm-hmm. that they don't want to instantly respond to everything and become totally reactive. At the same time, they need to move in certain directions. Yeah? They need to evolve, and that slowness is, and the resistance to change, is actually perfectly reasonable. But also, people need to push, and some people need to break. Yeah? And you need to have those breaks and those pushes. And I think that you need to think about how the protocols that exist, how they can be used to push it in certain directions. And certainly, the whole exhibition and you know, what we did also in relationship to architecture, but also in relationship to the politics of the exhibition, were super important for us, and you know, it was an exhibition with three artists, which I think also had certain relationships to migration politics or whatever in them, and that this was actually very important, I think, also for the museum to see that was something. That
and who else was there?
Naim Mohamian with the famous three videos, and Gluklia from Stodelat, who had done a project with migrants in Amsterdam. And very aesthetically very different, but I think in content had some relation.
Yeah, I remember, I think there was an interesting tension that I think emerged also in this last round, which is that Charles was speaking from the side of the institution, no? And we understand, you know, we understand that somehow you want to make the institutions better, to be open. But this also was his task and not us. I mean, it was not what, in a way, was more urgent for us. And therefore, the question was for us also how the museum is instrumental for something that's not just to make the museum better, you know, from the point of view of the institutions, but also how you can reuse the museum for different aims that are not necessarily inscribed, or you counter-inscribed other practices. And I think it was an interesting ways, you know, which somehow we say we are not interested in institutional critique, we are not interested in per se. I think we actually like the fact that somehow there is someone is working in this direction, but this is not what we are interested in. And it's more about how an institutions actually can be ejected for something that was not planned for. I think that also emerged as an interesting way that we were looking at the museum as we looked at Israeli colonies in Palestine, and we say how we can use a colonial structure for aims that were different from the one we're performed, including that there are, you know, other people that would be using it in completely different ways. Because most of the interventions, in fact, they exist beyond the museum itself. So the museum becomes just one of the instruments that one can use, but not an important one per se. So it's the idea also not to only close ourselves in the fact that we want, you know, ultimately is successful because it's reformed, or is more understanding how that operates into the larger schemes that then suddenly becomes something else. And I think that was, for me, exceptional when we see there were so many things happening before the people were entering in the museum. You know, there is a way that then what was happening, because the living room there, it was just at the entrance. Mm. And we discussed a lot about this possibility of where should be located. Mm. And that is actually very important. Is it possible that this is the way how you enter the museum, and therefore your behavior is not already inscribed in the ways in which you would start to look all what comes after that? I mean, that would be, for example, something that we start a little bit to talk about.
Yeah, that was, might be the follow-up. Yes. We have to come back on.
Yes.
I can't help not like reading these two projects together, the Bowdoin, as I know the Bowdoin project pretty well, and the museum project. And what I find fascinating is the negotiation of thresholds, but also how very different they play out, the two projects. Because what happens in Bowdoin, in the society, Swedish society, where the private public domain is strictly divided, is that what is created is a, it's not even a semi-public space. It's something more like, you know, in Swedish you would call it an allmänning, like it's something rather as the commons, where the whoever holds the key is both responsible and sort of in the right of hosting. So there's something outside of the public-private sort of, and where the threshold in Tudor space was so central, where the people owning the house wanted to set up this booking system that had it could book it, then that was never the point. That's the point that there must be a host, yeah? Now what did you call them? Like notable. So it's very interesting, and then we put in a place that is so specifically public, that sort of where the living room gains weight by having this sort of museum public label upon it, it becomes a completely different sphere. But it's still about negotiating the threshold.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So there's something like they differ a lot when you read them from this perspective.
Brings more privacy in
in some sense. Yeah, into that one, while in the room, it's, I mean, it's a private housing complex, but it creates something in between. Or it creates a community. It creates a community in a way.
But also, if you would think that what was the first operation of Boden was to destroy the walls of, to destroy part of the walls of this yellow house, right? I mean, we operate on the ground floor and we open the living room by destroying some walls, while in the museum we built some walls.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is like, it's a major difference, because there you need to open the private to the public, and here you need to sort of raise the public into a sphere where you can actually become a host in your own terms, and without walls there is no way for it to happen. So in that sense, I think that both goes into the operation of the threshold, but in two different directions in terms of architecture. One you destroy and one you build, but both for the same reason, right? And one to destroy a private to open it to the public, and the other to expropriate, if you want also to put it this way.
Yeah, exactly. But then in the museum, I assume everyone who passed by was welcome to enter.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it's in this location, which. I mean, there are two entrances to the museum, so there's also one through the cafe, so some people would have some walk to it, but if you came into the other entrance, then people you would immediately encounter it. But it's in a space that's
the host, where a lot of times Shafiq would just like stop everybody and invite him, and same would be happening.
But there was
was also that in a certain way Shafiq was also cleaning the space, no? Let's see, it became also a space where they organize themselves almost, because then in the end they were saying, we need this space, and it's in a public sphere, it's not anymore in a private or in a domestic space.
Yeah.
Then it becomes also a space that with the potentiality to be or to organize the community in that sense.
So that is similar, though, like building a community in between us.
There is the potential to build a different community, but in a public sphere, because the museum in that sense is a public sphere.
But also, I can't find it now, but I mean, we had a WhatsApp group and it became a kind of a selfie session, no, with everybody, all the hosts always taking photographs of who was there, and you know, so you would constantly get, I can't find it now, but there are, you know, lots of WhatsApp photographs basically of
I mean, all the photos I have from the living room in the Van Abbe comes from this WhatsApp and they every day there was a WhatsApp ting 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 ting, and I go, okay, this is the Van Abbe
sending
updates.
But that was really nice, because it did sort of document exactly those sort of encounters when you know, people from different backgrounds were coming together. And I think, you know, I take Alice's point very much about, you know, the different objectives that we have. And I think it's important, as, you know, I talked before about this idea of somehow the artists and the institution being kind of friendly enemies in a way. And then they're also trying to get things out of each other. I think it's right that I have a institutional objective and that Alessandro doesn't, you know, like I don't think we should meet, and agree and say, okay, yeah, no, aren't we? We're great. We're all doing the same thing. We're not actually. It's that's maybe important to recognise, and not to try and, you know, in this sort of constant enlightenment form of always trying to smooth everything over so that there are no conflicts or whatever.
Here we have you want to.
Yeah, what do you like about your intervention in European museums is, because European museum is still based on colonial demand of understanding, right? Transparency. You should understand the other on the colonizers still. So we have this demand for understanding without interaction. So your intervention is kind of bringing in interaction, and for me interaction is senses, and you know, tasting different taste, touching. I mean, in like here, body is touching, you know, which is against Swedish protocol. Definitely not should touch other, you know, bodies. Or listening, you talk about decolonizing, listening. I mean, when you mentioned this Afghan who couldn't read Arabic, that kind of translation, you know, this is a different kind of listening, that not all Muslims speak same language, yeah? Mm-hmm. So they are the diversity between, you know, the other. So I think you bring this kind of interaction which has been excluded in this demand of understanding, yeah? So I like how you arrange this road.
Can I add a very small point also, because, you know, that's also a discussion we have. Because, you know, for Charles was that I don't want the white box, you know, say, no, we want to work inside the modernist white box and do something with it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that also was an important claim, because otherwise we felt trapped into the same, you know, idea that then the museum, you know, will make like a special room for refugees, you know, that, but then the real stuff stays.
Mm-hmm.
So one
exactly.
of the claims that we made, you know, we want to be there and we want to make something there that can change forever, not, you know, just to be included in a way that once again, you know, perpetuates the same kind of violence in some ways. So in that sense, we were very much interested on the installations in a very traditional sense, you know, not to give up the idea that these are social practices. They are something else. There is a different category, but you know, the real things, the real art is always happening there. So how the things that we do, you know, have an effect. Also, you know, it's not my main objective, I have to say, but also, you know, they should have an effect on that is considered pure art. So that, and then, you know, how all this discussion also is materialized in a way they have their own values also inside the modernist museum itself. Otherwise, it become like an easy game to say, we continue to be the modernist, and we have this added that is happening, which is very nice.
And I think that also, I don't know, it's in Moderna Museet here, but in a number of institutions are sort of expanding their narrative to include other geographies, but they're not changing the narrative. So this is this sort of notion of inclusion, which I think is really problematic, because actually what it does is it even strengthens the Western narrative through saying actually everybody is in support of Picasso being the greatest artist or whatever. Everybody lines up to approve.
That's exactly the problem with diversity.
Yeah.
Right? Like, diversity is used against us. You know, this is exactly.
Yeah. But diversification is something which is going on. In other words, you have societies which are, you know, from 30 years ago, say in Eindhoven, there are many, many more differences between people. And that's also on class and in terms of the individualization. So it's not only about ethnicity. I think often diversity comes down to this idea of ethnicity. And I think we need to see it as a much more complex form of separation, because diversity also is about separating.
Yes,
Johan.
I'm curious about the notion of opposed when it comes to the organizer. I mean, the public art agency was the organizer, or you could say even the host of the project in Berlin. I mean, the host of the host, so to say, the host of you. And then in the Van Abbin Museum, the museum was the host of the project. And you have done it yourself, you did it yourself from your own initiative, and you are the host. And you have your own agenda, we might say, as an artist. You have something you want with this project. You want to change the role of the host and the guest. You want to look into this. And what I can hear from you, Charles, is that you have your own agenda from the museum. You want to change the role of the museum in the society. You want to do what several museums want to do, maybe reach out to new audiences, rethink the role of the museum and the public art agency. This organization has also its own agenda, its own mission statement, so to say, different reasons to also fund these different projects. So my question is basically, how do these different agendas play into the actual project, and how do you, Sandy and Alessio, how do you play, how are these, how visible are they? Do you play with them or against them? Is it important or not?
Do you want to?
I mean, one thing that we all the time discuss about is that how important it is to work in and out institutions. We never give up with the institutions, and we never thought that we are sort of, you know, there are some people that decided that the institutions are out, and that, you know, there is no way to change anything together with, and they decide to more work outside of the institution. In our case, it wasn't like this, and mainly I have to say that it was even, I would push further to say that because we are both architects to begin with, and we all the time work in the ground, and we worked for so many years in refugee camps, while we were working in such hard conditions, and you understand that the ground is very hardly negotiable, you cannot ever do whatever you think you should negotiate. If you departure with a 100% idea, it will become 20% on the ground, and you should accept it. There is no way around it. And for us to find ourselves with institutions like the Public Art Agency or the Van Abbe Museum or wherever, they give us a sort of a blank card to play in a way where we can see the 90% of our ideas becoming true in these places. And this is when Alessandro says, you know, we want to play in the white boxes, because this is for us a way to just get from the ground in that place and experiment our ideas to its highest potential. No, and then you come back to the ground and things are different. But in a way, we don't, I mean, both the ground and the museums actually speak to each others in our work. And we, sometimes even certain works begin as an art installation and then go back to the ground, or we begin in the ground and we come as a refuge to these institutions. So I would guess, you know, refuge is a very good word, mm-hmm. and refuge to actually for our mind to still go to its maximum potentiality is something that we all the time first enjoyed very much, because, and second, permits us to continue working on the ground. Otherwise, to continue working on the ground thinking that we can change, because sometimes you work on the ground and give up. No, and the only way that we were able not to give up was because we got these safe places where we managed to, you know, thanks to our highest potentiality, if I would put it this way. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, you wanted to, and then Joanna.
Yeah, I wanted to add.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. No, go ahead.
Because, like, working in the public space, of course, there are, like, not only the public agencies' agendas, there were many agendas in Bhutan. For instance, the housing company wanting to regenerate the area. I mean, that, and for instance, having meetings with the migration office that are doing a whole new system for Swedish migration housing that maybe wanted to include this in, like, in a change that is politically quite dubious. But I think you have, I mean, so there are layers, obviously. But I think you also have a point to say, like, coming from architecture, there is maybe a smaller fear of instrumentalization. Because then, now maybe I'm saying my own words and not sort of putting it into your mouth, but there is something in this. The role of the artist slash architect in relation to instrumentalization that differs.
But I think it's a really good question that Johan asks, and I think a valuable one. But I think also the instrumentalization that goes on is something that's good to recognize. But I think it's almost always inevitable, you know. And I think that this instrumentalization is something that goes on anyway. The modern canon, if you like, built up this idea of autonomous art, which was always a fiction. Mm. Right? It was always a fiction that relied on a certain sense of things that were, that things not being visible. You know, certain ideologies, certain structures, mm-hmm. certain ways of thinking not being visible. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that we have now is much more visibility about those structures of instrumentalization that are going on. And sometimes people think, oh, well, that means that we're sort of, you know, instrumentalizing things that shouldn't be instrumentalized. But actually, I don't think there's a way of avoiding that. You know, we have different interests, which aren't necessarily conflicting interests, but are different interests. And those different interests are part of why certain things happen. So certainly, you know, Sanya Alessandra in the museum is not just a gift. You know, it's also a use. There's a mm-hmm. use that we have of them, and that hopefully a use of, well, not hopefully, a use that you have of us. And we're using each other But that's not necessarily a bad thing, I don't think. Mm-hmm. But it's something that should be recognized, rather than this idea of the museum as either, you know, something endlessly bountiful and beneficent, or the museum as a kind of neutral space in which anything can happen. I don't think it could ever be that. I can't imagine a world in which such autonomy existed. Maybe in heaven, but nowhere else, I don't think.
I have him, Ian, and then here. Yes, it's super.
Well, thank you very much for your presentation and the conversation. I enjoyed it a lot. And I do agree, I think I really appreciate that idea that we should not really give up the institution. It is actually very important, because and we cannot really take those institutions for granted neither. There is, of course, a lot of activities and a lot of artists and colleagues that they want to go outside of IQ, as you know, the discourse community. But as you know, of course, you know, all of these contemporary art institutional museum are actually, or any form of contemporary art practice, is actually the first target for the right wingers. That as soon as they're getting a little bit poverty, they're trying to shut out those kind of activities. It's happening right now in Skåne, mostly in Sweden, the Sverige Demokraterna, for those municipalities that they got a little bit more voted, they're trying actually to cut the budget for the contemporary art institution in Konstfall. So engaging with those institutions, I think, is very, very important. Mm. Yeah. And if there is a possibility for that kind of engagement, of course, we have to really do as much as possible, as best as possible. Well, this is a kind of, you know, I think I really appreciate that work. However, of course, back to the history of the museum in the modern society, is very much based and rooted in the colonial position of it. But the other things that I think is very interesting in relation to your practice, if I put the things that you have done in ArtDesk and also the experience that you have, the one that you explained it, and with Shafir's involvement, I really like the notion of translatability of this project. Mm. We had that conversation a long time ago, that it's very interesting to see that notion or practice of hospitality does belong to the certain geopolitical condition, which I could actually even generalize it as the global south. And that form of hospitality sometimes, of course, as we are from the global south, it became sort of hospitality, as again, Drida mentioned in the radical hospitality. And I, for me, it's very interesting, that part, that how is it possible to bring different ideas into your living room idea and see that how we could create sort of collectiveness and solidarity among those kind of social political agencies that they are assumedly host in the guest in the Western society. Mm-hmm. And of course it's not really about people, just about people from the Middle East. It could be actually people from the other form of geography that they practice the notion of hospitality.
Mm-hmm. Should we take all the comments and then have
I have a question related to the dilemmas that arose from this proposal to acquire the living room.
Mm-hmm.
Because I remember we spoke last year that somehow you think of a collection as a place where you don't only collect objects, but you collect relationships. You know, that this is like one of the ways you were thinking.
But
like anti-intimidation policy of a museum, right? Because museums, as we know them, feel very often so intimidating. So this seems from the first sight like an ideal proposal playing in your hands, but I'm sure it brings some dilemmas. So can you, from your perspective and how do you feel about this acquisition idea? Or which are the dilemmas, maybe, you know, like?
I don't know, I mean, to begin with, is you know, how you would acquire something where it is about people's for myself I see this each time the project is into a second phase, it changes, and there is no way of, I mean, maybe the word acquiring is a bit not fully fitting the nature of the project. So I mean, from my side, I don't know. I mean, when I heard the word acquisition, it's sort of, it felt wrong. But I don't have any idea why it is wrong. What and you know, in our case at least, I feel it all the time, is that we go first by intuition and then maybe we would understand it 8 years later of why we felt this way. But I don't have a very rational sort of, you know,
I think that is very much the discussion that we just had of how, in that sense, maybe this could be possibly a place in which the museum has to radically change
mm-hmm.
in order to adapt to a practice that cannot be captured
mm.
in this modernist terms.
Mm.
I think that there is a tension, there is a need of something that needs to emerge, that
mm-hmm.
goes, you know, beyond finding, you know, just a small trick that
yeah.
become like a little bit, you know, closing itself, but how, what are the requirements that respect the kind of interventions that every time is happening, you know, and the notion of time, for example, that we start to discuss, you know, the museum, people believe, you know, in permanency in the museum, you know? Which is like almost a religious,
mm-hmm.
I don't know how.
It's in the statutes.
Yeah.
No. I mean, it's like a dogma. Forever. I mean, it's
we're not allowed
idea
to sell anything.
Yeah,
that
museum provide permanency is something incredible, no? That people believe still in.
Or the artworks.
The collections, you know,
yeah.
you become part of history
yeah.
and blah, blah, blah. So how somehow also the in our work, for example, from the refugee camps, you know, we start to question ourselves why temporariness is not as value as permanency.
Mm-hmm.
Why we give yeah. all this value to something that become permanent and something that exists only as a temporal, you know, you start to think about how many things actually shape who you are and they are not permanent, you know,
mm-hmm.
including ourselves. So, but that is where the colonial apparatus is so much in us that it's difficult to dismantle in some ways.
But it forces also
yeah.
the museum to go out of this market-driven thinking, no? Because
yeah.
you have to find another way. You cannot buy relationships in a certain way, but you have to give them also another value. And you have to value also the objects and relations that you have in as a collection in a certain way or in the museum.
I think what's interesting is that acquisition, in a way, implies possession and implies
mm.
scarcity, and that's less and less true.
Mm.
So, you know, you have these absurd situations, even like video work, where somebody will buy a museum will buy a video work in order to show it, and actually it will also be on sale in the old days, a DVD or as a download for, you know, like 20 euro, and the museum's bought it for 200,000 euro, and,
mm-hmm.
and this. Yeah, this is something where the market hasn't quite worked itself out, and you see then that the museums are really just there in order to burn the excess in a certain sense. You know, they're not really that interested. They're interested in having the ability to say, "I have Matthew Barney or something built," when it's also available online. And I think that, you know, there are a lot of protocols around the museum, particularly around acquisitions, which are very interesting to challenge, but also really difficult. So, you know, I mean, one example would be this. Another example would be the Arte Utile archive that has kind of been built collectively by many people. But I mean, one of the problems that we had around bringing that into the collection, which it still isn't completed actually, but it's the problem that there isn't an artist. And this sort of fundamental protocol that in order to acquire an artwork, it has to have an artist. Huh? So if you don't have an artist, what are you acquiring? Who are you acquiring from? And if there's no who, but there's something else.
There isn't an artist as an owner. There isn't
a pre-existing owner who produced it, who can then give you the rights, which are also quite limited rights. Yeah, the rights to the often the rights to the object itself, but not to its reproduction, which these days makes much less sense in certain ways in terms of the kinds of monies that are being talked about. So all these aspects, I think, it shows you the gap between the institution as it is and as it was formed, largely in New York, and how the institution and its experiences in the world, in a way. And this is the kind of experience of the institution in the world, which should force the institution to think about the inadequacy of its protocols. But that's terrifying for many people, yeah? Because if you change the protocols, then what stops you buying anything? You know, that's the kind of the attitude. If we do this, then that means that everything becomes possibly acquirable, and then nothing becomes acquirable. Mm. And the collection kind of loses its meaning. And that's the fear, I think, about losing these protocols, that then you lose everything. And it's not an unreasonable fear as well. You need to think about what that would mean.
That would mean a huge opening for museums to act in a very different way.
Yeah, I think so. Mm. But what really are its implications? I think often what I feel asked by my colleagues often is, okay, if you do that, then that means this and this and this and this. And you have to sort of define, in order to change the protocol, you have to define all the consequences. And you know, sometimes conversations feel like it's sort of 20 questions, where they go, well, okay, well, if you do that, then this is true. And if that's true, then this is true. And they end up in some absurd place.
But where, it would be very,
you know, the museum is doing a one-to-one map of the whole world or whatever. You know, they get nervous. And then you have to sort of wind it back and say, well, no, that's not what we mean. But there's a lot of implications in those questions. Yeah, it's very good for the museum to be challenged like that, but it's also, it would be wrong that we end up trying to produce a one-to-one map of the world or whatever, you know, and acquire everything.
I'm trying to.
I have a comment that I can really shape a little bit according to this that was before. I mean, we've been discussing your project many times, so I find it very fascinating that it's also kind of a search for you. I mean, it's kind of not only an art piece, but it's an artistic process and research, and that you've also been struggling a lot with thoughts around where this project will take you and so forth. And I find that very interesting, and possibly also in relation to what it means to bring that into a museum. But maybe it would be interesting if you would mention a little bit about this, because I mean, you also had a bit of a fear that this would go out of your hands and what would happen in that case, or if it would be brought somewhere else, etc., etc. Now I know that maybe you cannot speak about this, but it's because you're being approached by different institutions and projects. And
so. No, I mean, I guess, yeah, you are pointing because in a sense, maybe this is my first project in the sense that touches, how can I put it anyway, is that it is my way of living in this moment. No, it's mm-hmm. like moving with this project is about also moving with my own self in mm-hmm. many ways, or also understanding my own self in a complete different ways, a departure with my question, can I live in Sweden as a guest? So a departure from this very strongly, from a very personal need mm-hmm. of answering this. And in that sense, what does it mean if I have to live as a guest? How can I live with dignity? Because, you know, one of the things that I really love in one of the verbs in Islam is that they say, you know, you can be a guest, a sort of respected guest for 3 days, but after these 3 days you would become an aid object, means that you, people will help you because of a pity, not because of and in that sense, and this is where actually for me Derrida collapsed, because Derrida collapsed the moment that you say, I give you the key, even if you will give me the key, where is my dignity out of there, right? You give me the key and you tell me, yes, I aid you forever. Mm-hmm. But then you are taking out of me what is the most important thing in my dignity and my humanity, right? And coming from there to say, okay, I can accept my being guest in Sweden for 3 days. But if we passed our last 10 years in Palestine actually fighting against this idea of looking at refuge only as sort of aid objects mm-hmm. and as refugees mm-hmm. in that sense, how I would accept it on my own self. I mean, in that sense, I saw it clear that all what we did in the last previous years is how refugees is still a very important political subject in our society, and if not the most important political subject in our society. And suddenly I find myself here having to face the the guest after the third year of the third day of being in Stockholm, right? And in that sense, you know, if I engage in Boden this way, if I am engaging here in Jaspis in this other way, if I engaged in the Van Abbe in this way, exactly because it has this drive. And I, and you know, this is maybe one of the if not the first project where people take completely over. I mean, Shafiq would take completely over in the case of the Van Abbe. Yasmin will take completely over in the case of Boden. Now I am in Alaska, and it seems that the museum and the municipality will take completely over on the level of a city. So in many ways, I think that actors change, things change, and it's super vulnerable as a project, because each time I am in a place, it seems that, you know, it has to do with me and my reading of the place and who I am encountering and who I'm, and I'm still even have no idea what this project is all about, right? But certainly it's first about me, about having, being able to actually navigate being in such white space and dealing with it. Because so far, I think that what happened is we went to Palestine and we had to deal with physical colonialism mm-hmm. constantly. And I have to say that sometimes it might even be slightly easier for certain things, because, you know, I mean, yeah. the enemy is present. Clear, it's present, you have the army, you have everything that makes it very clear where is it that, well, here it's all benign, no? It's all around you, but very benign and very, and for me, I think that if working with the whole notion of decolonization, I arrived to a point that, you know, you don't touch my, I mean, there are certain red lines that I feel almost a physical, I arrive to a point where I feel a physical reaction to certain things before even understanding them intellectually. I mean, my body would say, no, here there is something wrong. I mean, I should not be a guest, or I should not behave this way. And maybe this was developed throughout the practice, I mean, all over. And in that sense, yeah, I mean, everybody is speaking about scaling up, asking for scaling up of this project. And I say, but, you know, what does that mean in terms of this is, you know, I don't know where I want to head, but certainly there is this dimension of the project being super personal, but in the same time, very much the first project where people take completely over and do their own things in a very interesting manner. So I want to keep these two tensions, mm-hmm. one to completely open it up, and on the other hand, not to, it's also very easy project to be instrumentalized. I mean, it's very easy that then if this in Alaska things would happen on scale of municipalities, then other municipalities wants to do it, and it can become a monster in many ways. So I mean, there is these dimensions of what is my role in that sense, and how not to create a monster. Yes.
I must say that the idea of the difficulty of being or having a guest for more than 3 days really applies to me. But it also makes me think about the notion of residency, because now you, Sandy, you are in residence at the Jaspis. And when we talk about residency, it's also about hospitality. So we, in one way, we are hosts. And an artist in residence is somehow, by definition, a guest. And as you say, you cannot be a guest for more than 3 days. I think that's totally right. So how do we work that out? And for in our practice, I think this might be valid for also other in other aspects, because I think it's very much about mandate and transparency. So we could not have artists in residence if we were not very transparent about the situation, what we expect, and what is the role of the artist, what is the mandate of the artist.
Mm-hmm.
And in residence theory, we talk a lot about reciprocity. So in terms mm-hmm. of the mutual expectation of mutual exchange.
Mm-hmm.
So the residency host always expects something. the funder expects something and the artist expects something. And you need to be very transparent about this, preferably in advance. Otherwise, you will have problems. And I think this applies, I think, to many relationships when it comes to the relationship of host and guest. And I think you can be a guest for longer than 3 days if you manage this kind of transparency.
I mean, I follow, in that sense, I would have to say that in that sense, the contract you are signing is a complete different contract. Because it's one thing when you sign the contract of host and guest. The way, for example, to put it in this way, the contract that is that certain European state is signing with refugees is that, you know, I am your host, you are my guest, you should behave, and this is the contract, right? I mean, there is, and in that sense, what I am speaking about these 3 days, this is like, it speaks to hospitality as a way of being, in a sense of verbal way of, I come to your house and I am your guest and you know how to treat me and on the other. But here, when people comes, they come with a complete different contract, which is not the contract that I would say apply to this dimension of hospitality, because in that sense it's much more almost a work contract where each one of people knows, and then people will negotiate their relation with the cities. This is something completely else, because I give you, for example, one example. When we had to do the exhibition in Abu Dhabi, I went there and I say I want to exercise my right to host, and we were given this apartment of the teachers in Abu Dhabi, where teachers normally stand. And there is a lot of separation between students and teachers. Mm-hmm. There is, you know, the dorms of teachers are inaccessible for students. And I say, I am here 2 weeks having an open living room, and each evening I had a dinner in that place. Each evening I have the security guards calling again and again, and they didn't understand at all that they can let the student in. So they were really getting mad out of this students in and out all the time, the dorm. But by exercising my right to host in a place like Abu Dhabi, a week after, I was walking in the campus saying hello to everybody. I became more local than the locals themselves, because I mean, in many ways they were all sort of visiting the place, and it's up to you to say, do I really apply to the game and I want to say exactly, I mean, I arrive here and I exactly to what Jaspis tell me, or I get inside the street and decide, I don't know, I would open my studio to all my neighbors here and begin to host. I mean, it's, and hosting is not necessarily, I don't know, it's not that we all need to host, but sometimes when you feel that this is your way of claiming dignity, then it makes sense. I mean, a lot of people lost this. And maybe when you don't lose it, and you don't, I don't know, but in a sense, I don't feel that this applies for all contracts in society. Otherwise, it would be maybe beyond our control and even understanding. It become maybe complicated. I think that once you sign a contract, it's a different contract. Maybe. What do you think? I don't know. I don't have a real answer to this. It's a very interesting question, because I am sitting here. I decided this is my living room. So in my own way, I am exercising my right to host in Jaspis. So in a sense, I also hosted you in dinner in Jaspis. So in many ways, in certain circumstances, you was my host and I was your guest. And maybe, you know, a possible answer to this is that I believe that a full human should be a guest and a host. You cannot be, because I all the time say, if you are only a host, you are colonial. Because, I mean, in that sense, I still remember my grandmother saying that when the British arrived to Palestine, we treated them as guests with honor, and they acted as masters. And my grandmother felt that she was stupid not to understand that they were acting as masters. So if you arrive to a place and you're supposed to be a guest and you act as a master, you are colonial. Mm-hmm. That's it. If you arrive to a place and you actually accept to act only as a guest, means that you are accepting not to be an active member of society and not an active subject, mm-hmm. and you accept your role mm-hmm. as a subaltern mm-hmm. person without role in society. And both of them are wrong. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, if you want to be a person yeah, with the full political agency and subjectivity, mm-hmm. you should be playing both roles. And the moment that we stop playing both roles, we should wait a minute and say what is wrong with mm-hmm. us. Mm. I think.
That is a question and also an observation. What is hospitality in different cultures is very, it's very different too. Like I don't think like in Sweden the term is exactly the same as in Greece and probably as is in Palestine. So have you got the difficulties with this one? Like what means to be a host? It's not in every country the same. Like the levels of control and what you expect and the levels of what is expected from you as a host, I think it differs quite.
And this is why actually the project differs. Each time it is in a different place with different problematics. But I guess I am much more interested, and this is why I would insist on the right to host and consider it right, because in many ways, especially, you know, I was speaking to this, it's heavy when you arrive to a place and people expect you should behave. I mean, this is for me, this was the heaviest thing ever, to be able to, you know, you arrive, you respect, but you don't, I mean, I respect the place where I am, but I don't behave. I mean, I want to be able to be a layer of persons. I want to be able to be myself. I want to be able to bring my own culture and myself. And I am fully respecting where I am, and I am grateful for many things, but I would not obey and behave, mm-hmm. right? There is a huge difference between respect and obeying, a huge one. And, you know, I am speaking to the fact that as if the state, especially when it comes to refugees, deciding that they are, that the state is the only host. They cannot be the only host. They cannot tell us that it is illegal that we, if we will find someone in the street and we want to invite him or her to sleep in our house, no matter what is it, I cannot accept that the state comes to me. And here it comes also to the right of the white people, not only the black among us. I mean, when the moment that your state comes and take out the right of hospitality from you, there is a lot to be thought about. You know, the moment that it's illegal to host whoever you want in your own private house, we are touching certain topics that needs to be completely open and rethought about, because it's not only about refugees, not anymore. So in that sense, I'm bringing hospitality more in a sense of, if I want to bring it this way, I am trying to politicize hospitality, not to have it as a very apolitical sort of thing where we love all each other and we come and have dinner and enjoy ourselves. It's part of it, but I think that what I am interested more in what I am doing is how much I see hospitality domain as a super political domain, with the simple questions like who is guest and who is host and who is entitled to be a host. It are big question in society today. So yeah.
Somebody,
yes.
I think maybe that was
we close here.
Yeah, no, but we can continue our conversation over a beer or a water or
fantastic.
Out here, because we would like